What is food as medicine, and why is it crucial to healthcare? We're about to dive into a field of medicine you may or may not be familiar with called culinary medicine. Hello, and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information from the world's leading experts on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, connect, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle as medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. And I am thrilled to be joined by Dr. Linda Hsu. Dr. Hsu is an internal medicine physician, chef, and founder of Thrive Kitchen, a teaching kitchen for patients at Kaiser Permanente San Francisco, where she's the first director of culinary medicine. She believes that the best medicine is prevention. Her cooking classes showcase seasonal produce, lavishly flavored in spices and fresh herbs. She's the author of the cookbook, Spice Box Kitchen, Eat Well and Be Healthy with Globally Inspired Vegetable-Forward Recipes, which was awarded a Gold Award in the 2022 Nautilus Book Awards and selected as a finalist in the 2022 International Association of Culinary Professionals Awards. Dr. Hsu is Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at the Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine and has served as faculty at the University of California, San Francisco, and Stanford University. She also serves as a member of the boards of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, Meals of Wheels San Francisco, and the Teaching Kitchen Collaborative. She's a graduate of Brown University, San Francisco Cooking School, UCSF, and the Kitchen of Michelin-starred restaurant Murad in San Francisco, and has a certificate in plant-based nutrition from Cornell University. Linda, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled to talk to you. We've taken different paths, but I feel like we've both ended up starting teaching kitchens at our organizations and have both ended up being members of the Teaching Kitchen Collaborative, which for people who may not know is a global collaborative started by the visionary Dr. David Eisenberg at the Harvard School of Public Health. And it's dedicated to changing lives through food. So I feel like we're career soul sisters, our soulmates. Prior to culinary medicine, what were you doing?
I was just a doctor. I was practicing primary care, and it was probably 10 years into my career that I went to David Eisenberg's conference, Healthy Kitchens, Healthy Lives, and I literally started teaching people how to cook less than a week after that conference. It truly changed the whole path of my career. So that was a little more than 10 years ago now.
Amazing. And career transitions are not easy. When you got that light bulb that this is something you're passionate about, how did you almost do a 180 and now this is what you do full time? So talk to us about how that transition came about, because I think a lot of people look for ways to pivot, but it's pretty challenging.
It is challenging. And to be clear, it wasn't a complete 180. I'm actually doing both. So I'm still practicing primary care. It's the majority of my job, actually. And the culinary medicine stuff, I do a small amount of time. So I am still always actually in process of trying to figure out how to make it all work, which is why, you know, the scheduling of this podcast and all that was complicated, because I don't have that much time that isn't dedicated to patients. But even in that transition, it's the kind of thing which, when people always ask, how did you get there? How do you do this? You can't plan this sort of thing, actually. I don't know if that was the case for you, but it's really just kind of the passion bringing me along the path and just figuring things out as they come. And I think it's the kind of thing too, where you can't, unlike the path to traditional medical practice, where you're pre-med, you apply to med school, you go to medical school, you do residency, you may or may not do fellowship. It's a pretty clear cut and well-worn path. There is no path to doing culinary medicine. And I think that that's why it's so interesting and people come to it through many different paths, because there isn't a dedicated lane yet at this time that brings everyone here.
Yeah, absolutely. And everything you said just resonates so much, because I understand kind of the challenges, and it's a passion-driven type of way to add to your career where you feel like you're making an impact. That's fantastic. And let's talk about food as medicine. So what does that mean to you?
What I've found is that after all these years of practicing medicine, which is now, I think, similar to you, I guess, coming up to 25 years of practicing medicine, whereas in the beginning, I wanted to, you know all the details of all the latest studies, do things in a very academic way, and I still want to incorporate all of that into my practice, making things as evidence-based as possible. But what I've realized after more than a couple of decades of being a doctor is that the simplest and most basic ideas are actually the most powerful and the best. And that certainly applies to how I practice food as medicine. I do want to know about all the latest nutrition studies, especially since they often contradict previous studies. And I do, since I'm practicing medicine all the time, thinking about the use of pharmacologic treatments and how that might integrate with it. But truly, food as medicine to me is actually translating in the most practical, simple, and flavorful ways to my patients of how they can use nutrition to improve their health. And that might be different for different people. There's an underlying basic commonality that I want people to eat more fruits and vegetables. I want people to kind of cut down on processed food, saturated fat as much as possible. That is true for almost everybody. But within that, it can be pretty specific and particular and customizable, including what they like to eat, including, you know, whether that comes from their culture or some other factor in their life that makes them want to eat one food more than another. But truly, food as medicine for me is, I understand the nutrition really well. I will explain it to you in its most basic way, but really it's teaching you how to cook in a way that allows you to implement that in your life.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that's crucial to healthcare?
Again, it's truly like I trained in like the highest sort of tertiary, quaternary level of academic medicine. But no matter what we have in terms of technology and medications, if someone isn't eating in a way that is supportive of their health, nothing we can do will help them get to their optimal health. And so I think of it as it's the lowest common denominator. And also, I think the most fun and the most direct way of connecting with people.
And for patients that come through Kaiser and the programs that you offer, what is the experience like?
So, of course, everything changed a lot with the pandemic. Prior to that, my classes were all hands-on, in person. Usually, I aimed for 12 people per class. They would probably go up to 20. Beyond that, it's kind of chaos when you're teaching people hands-on. What I loved so much about that, it was, you know, just like a maybe the equivalent of a group therapy session. It wasn't just me instructing people. It was those interactions and the community building that I think made it a very rich experience where I wouldn't always anticipate what questions people would have. Or some people would be, you know, really good experienced home cooks themselves, and they would share a tip. Those sorts of things were, to me, like the richness of the class. So we would basically have five or six different recipes that teams of four people would create, a couple of those each. And then we would all have them together, join all of our tables together at the end for a group meal. And that's when we would talk about health and nutrition and cooking, all of those things in a very relaxed environment over a meal. So that's something that was very special and that I truly love. But unfortunately, since the pandemic, I've been virtual, but I'm seeing that that has its own benefits. I can teach many more people at once. And I think reaching more people is always a good thing. And it makes it more convenient for people and also, I think, more accessible in many ways because it's from the comfort of their own home. They feel, I think, I also do it actually from my home kitchen. So I think they feel like, okay, you don't need to have any fancy equipment. You don't need to rush anywhere. They're more relaxed because they're not rushing to get there after work. They're just coming home and cooking with me. It has many of the same benefits, still not quite the same as in person, though.
When you're designing the recipes, how do you decide which recipes to pick? What is like foundational, if you will, for your recipes?
So I think the biggest foundation is that all of my classes are vegetarian, with many of those being vegan recipes. but not that I tell people that they all have to be completely plant-based or completely vegetarian, just that I know from my experience that most people are deficient in fiber and other nutrients that are found in vegetables. And from a culinary perspective, many people actually don't know how to make vegetables taste good. And I love that challenge. I think even after going to culinary school, I find it most interesting to coax the best flavors and textures out of vegetables. And so I like to help people in that way. So that's kind of the basic level of the classes. Beyond that, I am very aware that many people eat in many different ways and come from many different cultures. So I try to have as many global recipes from around the world incorporated into my sessions. And I have a different menu each month.
I will also say that your cookbook is stunning, and I've loved seeing the recipes from different parts of the world. What led you to write the cookbook?
So I think any author of any sort of book, cooking included, writes it because they have to. Like, there's this sort of drive, this internal drive and need of, you know, ideas that you really want to get onto paper for posterity. But also for my book is kind of structured the same way as my classes. Some of the recipes I have taught in my classes, they're all very similar to how I teach my classes in terms of being, first of all, global from many different cultures, using a lot of spices, flavor really primarily, and also some of the health benefits of spices. And really wanting to be able to reach more people than I could in these very limited by design classes. So that was really kind of what structured the book. But all of the places that I've chosen recipes from are places that I have some sort of connection to from around the world. So it's basically structured so that I broke it down into different geographic regions of the world. And that kind of was how it made sense to me in terms of how people would learn to cook, how they might stock their pantry with spices, but also in terms of just thinking about how in these different cultures. So I start with California and I have some Mexican recipes there, moving to Asia, which is mainly East Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia in terms of recipes. The Mediterranean, and then finally Trinidad from the Caribbean. To think about, you know, how if you group these different recipes together, reflecting on how these different cultures talk about food, the kinds of things that they like to use, and the kinds of spices that might be in the pantries. But also, these are all parts of the world that have a tradition of really enjoying vegetables. I think that's most obvious to people for the Mediterranean diet, and that's why I wanted to have that section there, in addition to really enjoying the food of those cultures. But also my connection there is, you know, when I was in culinary school, the restaurant that I staged in was a Moroccan restaurant. So that was my connection there. For the rest of the sections, I have more of a personal connection, whether it's through my own heritage or places that I've lived or spent a lot of time. I really wanted to highlight in their traditional recipes, in their original forms, how meat, non-vegetable parts of those diets were really very limited, really there for flavor or maybe as a luxury. The vegetables really shine in those recipes. And to kind of underscore the point, I think that people often forget is that there isn't one healthy diet. Every culture has a healthy diet. And so I wanted to show that through as many different recipes as I could.
Why did you pick spices as the theme throughout the book?
I think in terms of having people wanting to eat healthy food, it has to taste good. And the easiest way to make food taste good and different and give variety so people aren't bored by what they're eating is through spices. And it also just happened to be that all the cuisines that I really enjoy tend to be really focused on spices. And then when I thought about, you know, what can I do as a doctor or as who I am and making this cookbook different from other cookbooks out there, spices made sense because they were our first medicine, right? Before we had pharmaceuticals or even are the basis of some of our pharmaceuticals to this day. It made a lot of sense that that could be a theme to carry the book through.
This is really all culinary medicine, but the term is maybe one that people aren't familiar with. Can you explain culinary medicine?
Yeah, there are many different ways to define this, which I think were first coined, really, it's been a while now, just maybe more recently, much more popular. But I think the first time that someone said culinary medicine might have been back in the 80s even. And John LaPuma, who's another internist chef, wrote this book of culinary medicine. He might have been the one to really popularize this term, although I'm not really sure if anyone knows who first said it. But basically it is, and I really like it, the definition that I like is the art of food and cooking combined with the science of medicine and nutrition. And I think that that kind of says it all, right? So it truly is using what we know from science and medicine, because we do need to make sure that this isn't just somebody saying, oh, yes, I heard that this is good for you. If you have this problem, eat more bananas. Some people will use food as medicine in that way, including my mother, who likes to send me a lot of articles that are questionable, maybe not evidence-based, about different foods and their health benefits. But I think importantly also how to do this, how to implement it, how to cook it in a way that you enjoy and will want to stick with. Because we know from a lot of different studies that people will only get the health benefits of some lifestyle change if they stick with it. We know that from the weight loss studies. There isn't one perfect diet, one match, even though everybody wants to say, I have the perfect diet for you. For weight loss, it ends up being whatever people can stick with. And whatever people can stick with for what they're eating is whatever they like to eat. And so I think that's why the culinary, using the word culinary in that part of it, not just nutrition. There is nutrition that's applied culinary nutrition as well. But without the culinary, it does not focus on flavor. And that's where we lose people. So that's why I really enjoy practicing culinary medicine, because it really combines those two very important parts of it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, food has to taste good and be healthy. And in terms of people eating healthy, I think there was a study that came out maybe about a year ago where people were surveyed if they felt they ate healthy, and about 85% of people thought they ate healthy, or most did, but 85% weren't eating healthy who thought they were eating healthy. So I think a lot of people think they're eating healthy. What are the key components in like nutritional science in terms of evidence of how do you define that for yourself, for the recipes that you create for people?
So there are many different ways that people talk about this, and some of them might be more extreme or might exclude certain food items or food groups in a very specific way more than others. I might even say I'm sort of agnostic about this. I actually do think that as we're kind of moving to the world of personalized medicine, we're not all the same. We're all more or less the same, but when you get down to the details of it, some people might do better on a lower carb diet. Some people might do well actually with lots and lots of carbs, and they'll actually feel that. So even before we get down into sort of the genetic studies of before we can do all these tests on personalized nutrition for people and have really believe that these are accurate and that we can implement them, I always encourage people to say, when do you feel better? After eating which particular foods, do you feel better? Do you feel worse? Listen to that, actually. Let's write this down, because this is actually who you are. And then let's work around that. But I think what is more universal for everyone is truly like, cooking is so important because that allows people to get away from ultra-processed foods. I don't think anyone disagrees that ultra-processed foods are wrong for everybody, at least as the basis of their diet. Sure, there's convenience, and I understand that, but there are different levels of processing. The less processed, the better for everybody. And as I also mentioned earlier, aside from people who might have IBS, where certain plant-based foods might be very tricky for them, but not all of them, in general, I think everyone benefits from eating more vegetables. And so I think those are the universals. And then in terms of kind of focusing on fiber for people, in addition to fruits and vegetables, whole grains as much as possible in a way that makes sense to people. Those are kind of the basics, but I think different people might have different preferences and different needs around eating animal-based proteins. For some people, it does make sense to be completely whole foods plant-based, but not for others. There might be others who, for whether it's cultural or medical reasons. So for cultural reasons, you know, there might be a food that is based upon meat that maybe that person wants to eat. It's important for them to eat it, even if it's just once a year. I would never say you can't have that if that's important to you. That's really crucial. And then from the medical perspective, for people who maybe like I have iron deficiency anemia, for example, and don't have other reasons why they want to exclude meat from their diets, maybe talking about how and how much that might be something that might actually make them feel better. but there's some in between. But with everyone, mainly, I want them to focus first on their fruits and vegetables and their whole grains. And then the other parts of it, I think, are customizable.
In the classes, what are the things that people enjoy the most and what are the things that are the most challenging?
My little bit of a sort of marketing tricks that I do, the only thing I don't do is label my classes as vegetarian or plant-based. I call them, you know, seasonal, which kind of brings you into that field, because I really think that a lot of people will be turned off by that. And I want everyone to eat more vegetables. That first challenge is getting people to come to your class, right? You want people to want to come and you want them to enjoy it. So my best feedback is when somebody will finish the class and then say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't eat any meat. I've never done that before and I really enjoyed it. So one is kind of, I guess, changing people's stereotypes or perceptions on what someone is going to try to force them to eat. People really do enjoy, when that light bulb goes off of, I've never liked vegetables my whole life and I really loved all of this and it was easy. I think kind of overcoming all of those stereotypes and barriers for why people don't already eat the way that I think might be better for them. Those are the challenges which I really enjoy and which I think I really do have a good skill at overcoming after all of these years of teaching these classes. And then I think people really do also, and it might be partially because I'm in California, which is very multicultural, where I think also people are very open to learning from others and other cultures. People really have a constant demand for like pushing me to make it even more international, to bring in even more spices and even more cuisines, because I have a lot of new students in my classes, but I also have a cohort of people who've taken every single class since I started them 7 years ago. So I think that is a big challenge for me, which I like. So right now I am writing the curriculum for next year. And there are some sort of foundational recipes that I like to keep every year, but I kind of make it hard for myself because I want to satisfy this small cohort of people who've taken all my classes, of changing it up and giving people new ideas. And one other kind of key concept that I'd like to share with people is that they can take my class, but I want them to think of it as a template, but that they're learning both kind of culinary skills and flavoring ideas, and they should switch it up for what they might prefer or for what they have.
If you had to pick five spices that were your top five, what would you pick?
That is such a hard question for me still and always. But I try to think of, I've answered this question many times. And so I try to think of what are spices that kind of go across cultures and that people might already be familiar with in one cuisine and then can then apply it to other cuisines. And so cumin would be one of them. So a lot of people come to cumin through either Indian or Mexican food. It's used widely in those. But all the cultures of the Middle East use cumin a lot. The cultures of the Caribbean may use cumin a lot as well. And a lot of people don't know that, but that in Chinese cuisine, because of the section of China that has a lot of Muslims that are from kind of the Silk Road area, cumin is used in some parts of Chinese cuisine as well. That's one example. It also adds a lot of earthy flavor. And I feel like that earthiness is what people who are used to eating a lot of meat and might be cutting down on meat can make vegetables taste better for them. So that's one. Another one would be smoked paprika, for that same reason where the smokiness is often kind of like bacony or tastes like other smoked meats to people. So for people, again, who are trying to reduce those things in their diet and feel like the vegetable is missing something, smoked paprika can often be what it takes to kind of round out that flavor for people. And then I like to include garlic. I guess I'm on number three right now. Garlic it's very universal in all cultures, but it has so many benefits in terms of cardiovascular health, both in terms of lowering cholesterol and lowering blood pressure. I think that's a great one that people are familiar with. And just to, you know, keep it there is really important as a spice in people's spice box. I guess I get a couple more. I will include ginger. Ginger, because it can be used in both sweet and savory applications and is used in most cultures around the world, but also that we know that it has many benefits for gastrointestinal symptoms, whether that is nausea, bloating. It's also a potent anti-inflammatory. And as we know, inflammation is the kind of the common denominator of many of the chronic diseases that we face. So ginger would be one of those. And then I actually want to have 6 spices. Can I have 2 more?
Go. This is great. Absolutely.
Okay. The other 2 are 2 other spices that people know from sweet applications or baking usually or desserts, cinnamon and cardamom. But in some cultures are used also in savory foods. And so I think let's start with cinnamon. Cinnamon is great because it tastes really sweet, I think even sweeter than sugar. And so it's a really great way of cutting down on added sugar when people are making sweet things and desserts. But also it helps with blood sugar and blood pressure control. And I think it has those added benefits there. Because I like to get people to think a little bit more about how spices do have health benefits. And it's not just for flavor, that actually maybe this might encourage them more to experiment in different ways, including using it in savory foods as well. For example, one of my favorite recipes from Morocco involves a little bit of cinnamon with eggplant. And you'll see that in Indian cuisine as well. And that's something which people haven't thought about a lot. And it's just something to play around with. And then cardamom is just kind of my favorite spice. I love the flavor of it. It's pretty complex and it can be used both in desserts and in savory foods like curries as well.
The points that you're making about the medicinal value of these different spices. For people who want to learn what spice to have for their condition or what they can try to treat their symptoms, what resources would you recommend?
So I recommend my book. I have a whole section in the beginning about spices, how to use them both from a cooking standpoint, but also what is known about their health benefits. Other resources, there are like some other spice encyclopedia type cookbooks out there that focus some more than others on what's known about their health benefits. So there are those out there as well, but I don't know that I can say that there are really a ton of resources that really focus on spices in a medical way. It's usually more culinary. And I would say Dr. Andrew Weil's website does have some resources on spices as well. But for interestingly to me, not too many people really focus on spices like in a very focused way in terms of talking about health benefits. It's really much more from a culinary standpoint. But in terms of like where to get spices and who can teach you a lot about those, there are lots of those resources out there. I think the most important thing for people to think about is the fresher the spice, the better. Just like with anything, just like there are expiration dates on our food, there are expiration dates for medications. Spices are all derived from plants. So they age just like any other food item. And for both flavor reasons and for potency, you're going to get much more effect if you have fresh spices. Ideally, 6 months, maybe a year at the longest.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything that we haven't had a chance to touch on that if you could wish everybody knew, was there anything that you'd want to share?
I think spices are really the thing that interests me the most, again, just because of the connection to flavor, to understanding other cultures and to their medicinal properties. I would like to really reinforce that I'd love for people to kind of play around with that a little bit more. And then beyond that, the concept that actually the simplest nutrition concept that I do kind of talk about in my classes is that the simple healthy plate model of looking at things where it makes it really simple, where people don't really have to know all the details to get all the nutrients into their diet. So, you know, to make half of their plate or their plate in a given day, their overall consumption, at least half of it, non-starchy vegetables. And to add to that, I would call it the rainbow healthy plate, all the colors of the rainbow, because those different colors correspond to different nutrients and to different antioxidants. I think that makes it really simple for people. Again, I like my messages to be very simple. And then to have the other 2/4 of that plate to be a protein, which does not have to be animal-based, can be fish or can be plant-based, and also whole grains for the other 1/4 of that plate. That is my nutrition message in a nutshell. And then to make it taste good in a way that people want to continue eating it so that it's sustainable.
You made it sound so simple. Linda, thank you so much. Thanks for the work you do. I think this is really trailblazing. I mean, I think you're building a path in medicine. And like you said, there aren't good resources for medicinal properties of spices. But there's so much that people could benefit from through spices, through vegetables, through culinary medicine. So Thank you for paving the way. I'm so glad you went to that conference 8 years ago and that you're taking along with you all the learners and future generations in healthcare so that this can become commonplace.
Oh, thank you so much. Those are really such kind words. I feel very lucky to do what I do because I truly am driven by my passion for this. And the best feedback is when my patients say, I make that all the time, or I shared that recipe with someone else. So it's very self-fulfilling. It's very rewarding to do this work. And for you to say those nice things about it means a lot to me. Thank you so much.
Good. And thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. I really love hearing feedback, so please leave a review to let me know what you think and rate this podcast. The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness and is copyrighted by Emory University. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.